From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Vice President Joe Biden will appear today with his new running mate, California Senator Kamala Harris, who was once his rival for the Democratic presidential nomination. Harris is the first Black and first South Asian American VP candidate on a major party ticket and just the third woman. You may remember Geraldine Ferraro and Walter Mondale, Sarah Palin with John McCain.
And you might remember when, after the killing of George Floyd, another contender, a candidate for president, and someone considered a possibility for VP, Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, announced she would not be seeking the nomination for vice president because she felt Joe Biden needed to pick a woman of color. Senator Klobuchar joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Robin. It's great to be on.
Well, it sounds like he listened to advice. Your reaction to Joe Biden's choice?
Kamala and I are friends. And sometimes when people run against each other, they don't even talk to each other again. It was much different with us. We became closer friends as the campaign went on. And I am so happy for her. I talked to her yesterday, and I can't wait to see what they will do together, not just as a ticket, but what she will bring to the office of vice president working side by side with Joe Biden. She knows how to govern.
It's fair to say you were two of the more moderate candidates. You were considered one of the most moderate candidates in the field. You and Kamala Harris, both prosecutors. Is this a missed opportunity to reach out to the progressive wing of the party, especially since it's assumed if they win, she'll be the party's candidate for president in 4 years?
I think, first of all, our party is unified. Look at Bernie immediately in a beautiful endorsement, endorsing Joe Biden. I see unity in our party. And I see in Kamala Harris someone who is progressive. She took on the ban on gay marriage in her state and helped to change the law. She fought big oil. You just go through her record, and she is someone that's standing with people. But I think more than that, right now, we are in the middle of a pandemic, and we need a team that's going to go in there. Those first 100 days are going to be critical. Know how to work with Congress to pass the legislation that we need. Look what's happened right now with the gridlock. And so that's why I'm just so excited about her as a choice.
Well, more questions. As I said, you're both prosecutors. Both came under fire. You for not prosecuting police enough. She for siding too often with police. So some are asking, is she the right choice in a moment when so many are calling for police reform?
She actually led the bill along with my friend Cory Booker. They led a major thoughtful bill on police reform. Unfortunately, the Republicans stopped it in its tracks, but it would have done things like ban chokeholds. And you look at her past, she has been someone that has stood on the side of justice. Do you get criticized when you're in hard jobs, especially as a woman? Of course you do. She and I both know that, as does every woman that's run for office. Kamala can take the criticism. And when I saw what Donald Trump said about her yesterday, instead of just saying, welcome to the race, welcome to the race, what does he do? He calls her those words that he has used against women throughout his presidency, nasty, angry. The adjectives I would use to define my friend Kamala Harris, words like tough, words like strong, words like empathetic and someone with experience.
What advice might you give either Kamala Harris or Joe Biden for appealing to voters in the Midwest? You said people want someone with rural policy experience, roots in the Midwest. Now your party has a ticket with two Democrats from liberal coastal areas. What words would you have for them?
I'm looking forward to introducing Kamala to the people of my state. And I know this about both of them. They get that we don't need a president for half of America. We need a president for all of America. Joe Biden has come to Minnesota multiple times. We have wanted him to come to Minnesota. And that's because he has this ability to bring people with him. And you saw it in the primary. You also see it in what's happening in the general election with people like Governor Kasich of Ohio endorsing him, a Republican governor who ran for president. And you see it in the kind of support he gets from union members, from people who have really been hit down by this pandemic. So I'm not one bit worried about how this team is going to do in the Midwest, and I'm looking forward to helping them.
You mentioned, of course, Kamala Harris, a woman, and a tough woman. We remember her line of questioning towards Justice Brett Kavanaugh when he was being vetted for the Supreme Court. President Trump mentioned that. Does she have a particular challenge. I remember when Barack Obama said that he couldn't afford to look like an angry black man, even when any other person in his position would just be angry. Does she also have to worry about being too tough as a woman?
No. What I have seen, and I think what the nation has seen, including in the debates, was someone that has shown grace under pressure. Sure, she's tough. She does her job. And I think one of the hardest things for all women candidates is that is sometimes perceived not as a positive, which it would be in men, but it's perceived as some kind of negative. Someone once said that men can run on their potential, but women run on their record. And if that's true, she's got both things. I just see this as something she has endured for years. I have endured for years. You're used to it, and you just rise above it.
Amy Klobuchar, Democratic senator from Minnesota, one-time candidate for the role her friend Kamala Harris is now taking, the Democratic nominee for vice president. Senator Klobuchar, thank you so much.
It was wonderful to be on, Robin. See you soon.
Health officials in Europe are worried about a second wave of coronavirus. Spain has the worst infection rate on the continent right now. France reports 2,000 new cases per day, and Germany's health minister is urging people in the country to follow social distancing rules as infections rise there. The BBC's Ginny Hill joins us from Berlin. And Ginny, is Germany seeing a second wave of the coronavirus right now?
Well, they're not officially calling it that, but there are certainly big concerns. In the last 24 hours, more than 1,000 cases, 1,226 cases were recorded. That's the highest number we've seen here since early May. The numbers have been steadily rising here for some weeks now. So we've gone from a situation where we were seeing maybe 200 or 300 new cases per day, which of course is relatively low compared to the size of the country, to suddenly now seeing around about 1,000 a day. That's really provoking a lot of concern amongst the scientists and the politicians here, as you can imagine.
Yes, there was a warning from the health minister about social distancing and wearing masks. Are people social distancing and wearing masks in Germany?
They are. And in theory, if you go into a shop or if you go on public transport, you should wear a mask. If you go into a restaurant, when you're not sat at your table, if you're just moving around or perhaps going to the toilet, you're supposed to wear a mask then as well. But I think as the weeks go by, people are starting to relax a bit. And there have been big concerns raised about particularly groups of youngsters gathering together for mass parties, some of which have actually turned quite violent. It's very warm here. People are outside. They're cramming down to the shores of lakes together. So you can see where the concerns come from. Other concerns are that a lot of people have been off on their holidays. They've taken advantage of being able to travel again. They're coming back into the country, some of them bringing infection with them. Schools are starting to restart as well. So there's a lot of talk about whether masks should be worn actually inside the classroom. One German state is saying that that's what needs to happen. But the main concern, I think, is generally people's behaviour. I'm in Berlin, speaking to you from Berlin, and actually the authorities here had a look around some of the bars in one district, and they found that just one in 13 bars was complying with corona sort of safety regulations. So you can see the problem.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned schools. Is there a consensus on how schools should reopen and the precautions that they're taking?
In some states, they've decided that masks should be worn in most parts of the school, although not actually in the classroom. Although at least one German state, the kids have gone back in the last day or two, is saying that you have to wear a mask in the classroom. That's teacher and pupils as well, which many people say, well, that's going to be pretty difficult for everybody concerned. Others say, well, it's absolutely vital to keep the children, the teachers, and of course, everyone who has contact with them safe.
The same story here in the United States. You mentioned a lot of people are coming back from vacation. Are there any restrictions on travel? I'm thinking about the rising number of infections in Spain and France. Can people from those countries get into Germany?
Yeah, I mean, the German authorities are doing what they issue what are called travel warnings. So at the moment, I think they're looking at Madrid, for example, and saying that's now looking a little bit too risky. But if you do come in from one of these risk countries or regions, then you're expected to have a test on arrival in Germany. But until they have that negative test, they're expected to quarantine. So that's how Germany's trying to tighten that up.
The United Kingdom is now in a recession for the first time in more than a decade because of this pandemic. Before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about the economic toll of all of this there in Germany?
The government here has basically taken the decision to throw a huge amount of cash at the problem. Germany for many years was very proud of the fact that it wasn't taking on new debt. And so in a very, very bold move, some would say, the government here decided it would take on new debt in order to finance a reconstruction programme to try and see Germany through this. But of course, there's a huge amount of concern about the impact on the German economy. But of course, it's not just the German economy, is it? I mean, the worldwide economy is all connected. And so there's a lot of concern here. You know, well, if other countries have trouble, that's going to have an impact on Germany, too.
That's the BBC's Jenny Hill in Berlin. Jenny, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
A day after Joe Biden's historic pick of California Senator Kamala Harris to be his running mate, President Trump tweeted, "The suburban housewife will be voting for me," a continuation of his not-so-subtle campaign warning that if Democrats win in November, low-income housing will invade the suburbs. Well, we also had some primaries yesterday. The Democrat Ilhan Omar won hers in Minnesota. And in Georgia, a Republican QAnon conspiracy theorist was victorious and could be in Congress in the fall.
Let's get more on this with Alice Stewart. Alice joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya. Great to be here.
Yes. So Kamala Harris, as we know, is the first Black and South Asian American woman vice presidential pick. This morning, she tweeted about the first conference call she and Joe Biden had together as running mates. Let's listen.
You ready to go to work?
Oh, my God. I'm so ready to go to work.
I was raised to take action. My mother knew that she was raising two Black daughters who would be treated differently because of how they looked. Growing up, whenever I...
And Alice is a Republican political strategist. Alice is, was picking Harris a bold move on Joe Biden's part, or safe choice, or both?
I think both. And Tanya and Robin, I think no matter what side of the aisle you're on, this is an exciting time in politics when we really flesh out the ticket and seeing Joe Biden bring on Kamala Harris. I think she is certainly someone just from the visual standpoint. She brings diversity and youth and energy to the Democratic ticket. And from a political standpoint, she is experienced. She's been vetted, having gone through the Democratic primary, and she's a fierce fighter. And those are good qualities that also add to what Joe Biden brings to the table. The question is, given that he has said he will more than likely just run for one term, and if for some reason, heaven forbid, he is not able to fulfill the duties, Kamala Harris would step into the role if they were to win. So her record will face really close scrutiny. And I have to say, as a Republican, and independents across the country will take pause with her record for eliminating private health insurance, supporting the Green New Deal, decriminalizing illegal border crossings, and giving illegal taxpayer-funded health care. So her record, I think, overall will face a lot more scrutiny than your normal vice presidential nominee will have. But that being said, from a campaign standpoint, this is a really exciting time to now that we get it really down to the brass knuckles of the face-off between Pence and Trump and Biden and Harris.
Well, speaking of Trump, Alice, not everyone feels this way. Trump actually does not feel this way. Let's bring in Angela Rye. She's a Democratic political strategist. And Angela, I mean, Trump went after Harris on race and gender today on Twitter. Yesterday, he called her nasty. And the first ad from the Trump campaign accuses Harris of being a sellout. Let's listen.
Kamala Harris ran for president by rushing to the radical left, embracing Bernie's plan for socialized medicine, calling for trillions in new taxes, attacking Joe Biden for racist policies. Voters rejected Harris. They smartly spotted a phony, but not Joe Biden.
Angela, I mean, might Trump's attacks on Harris actually backfire on him? Are Republicans struggling how to define her?
Well, they'll backfire with the folks they normally backfire with. The real question is for the 50% of people, white people, who are supporting and doubling down on white supremacy this election. That's who that question needs to go to. So I would invite you actually to ask Alice that question, who just said a lot of stuff about Kamala Harris that is not true. In fact, I'm questioning where she actually got her record from, because it sounds like it came from the RNC out of a memo, a messaging memo this morning. But I reject, just like I stand with 700 black women who signed an original letter last week about the racist and sexist tropes being used against all of the black women contenders at that point. And I'm not surprised at all that these things continue into this week. And we'll be ready, prepared, fully equipped to combat all of that nonsense going into this fall, especially.
Well, Angela,
when...
Angela Robin in here jumping in. I know you've been chafing at the bit too, because we had trouble getting you on with the technology, but here you are. Just take one or two of those things, because Alice, you did say that Kamala Harris was for getting rid of the insurance industry, I think it was, or something like that. That is not true, is it, Angela?
No, and I think furthermore, what we really have to be talking about, rather than getting rid of the insurance industry, let's stop talking about profit around healthcare. And let's start talking about, especially with the hundreds of thousands of people who have died in this country due to COVID. Oh, it's time for us to be talking about healthcare and what people need to survive. So instead of talking about the insurance industry and how to double down on those tax credits and the tax benefits that these corporations so desperately need, let us begin to talk about what people need in this country to survive. The talking points are all wrong, and the focus is all off.
Well, Alice, let's bring you in to respond to some questions about Republicans. In Georgia yesterday, the Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene won her primary. She has called the billionaire Jewish activist George Soros a Nazi, says there's an Islamic invasion of the U.S. government, believes in the insane QAnon conspiracy that Democrats are running a child sex ring and trying to bring President Trump down. She's, Alice, one of maybe 14 Republican QAnon candidates. Here's one of her latest ads.
The fake news media hates me. Big tech censors me. The D.C. swamp fears me. And George Soros and the Democrats are trying to take me down. But they don't scare me. Socialism does. That's why I'm running.
Alice, what does this say about your party, the Republican Party, a QAnon backer, potentially in office?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, the QAnon conspiracy is ridiculous and stupid. Let's just get that out of the way and quite clear. Look, I hate to inform Green, but Democrats aren't the only one that have a problem with her. There are traditional Republicans, myself included, who think her comments are outlandish and absurd and disrespectful. I'm from Atlanta, born and raised there. Have a lot of friends that obviously my family still lives there. I talked with some Republicans this morning about this, and traditional Republicans in Georgia are really discouraged that
they won,
and they're not going to stand by her because she's a loose cannon.
But they can't get their party leaders to do anything about it. Kevin McCarthy and President Trump hasn't disowned it.
It is the reality of the day is that it's ultimately up to the voters to decide. And the people in her district obviously voted for her. She won 57% of the votes in this race, and she will certainly win in November, given the makeup of that district in Georgia. But it is the people's decision to decide. I strongly have always opposed political leaders dictating who should run and who people should vote for. It's for the people of each district to make the decision as to who they vote for.
Angela, I want to bring you in to talk about something else. So I want to talk about Minnesota's Ilhan Omar. She won her primary yesterday, the last of the so-called squad of young women, first termers to do so. Omar supports diverting some money from police departments towards social justice services or social services. The progressive wing of the party is on the rise. Is that going to scare off some voters in the fall, do you think?
Well, let me just first say congratulations to Congresswoman Omar, who has withstood hate-filled attacks and rhetoric, has withstood and undergone death threats galore. And yet she stuck to her principles, and she secured her second term. What I think is that we have to be unafraid of having conversations that make sense in this country, particularly around policy, because behind every written policy are human beings. And so I actually applaud Ilhan for having the courage to say, you know, there's some funds that go to police departments that don't particularly serve us well. I would invite the listener to have conversations with police officers on when they get some of those calls, what are some of the things they wish they did not have to respond to? That's a conversation that I've had. I have a cousin who's a retired police officer, and he said far too often they are asked to respond to calls for mental health services, to move someone homeless, to send someone whose kid, you know, is trying not to go to school, to respond to that. That is beyond their scope of duty and their mission.
Angela, I want to ask you, though, what do you think, though? Do you think, though, this this progressive messaging, as folks are calling this, though, is going to scare off some voters in the fall who may not be as progressive?
And I guess what I'm saying is, I hope not. What I started with is what I meant, and that is that I really think it's time for us to have courageous conversations instead of engaging in fear-mongering. And that's why I applaud what she's doing, even if we don't always agree with every tactic. But I think defunding is about divestment, and it's time for us to have that conversation. Go ahead.
I got to jump in. And Alice, we only have about a minute left, and we haven't talked in a while. I'd love to say, hey, how's your summer? But instead, I have to ask you this. COVID-19. Do you think Donald Trump is going to go down as the president who led possibly the worst health care response in history? And we'll take your party down with him. And I'm sorry, I got a minute for you.
Well, I think it's quite clear that we have a lot of work to do with regard to COVID. I think the administration now is focused on making sure that we work hard and quickly on getting a vaccine, that we work on testing, we work on contact tracing, and we work also importantly simultaneously to open up schools and businesses to get America back on track.
And that was Alice Stewart, who is a Republican strategist, and Angela Rye, who is a Democratic strategist.
The first wave of COVID-19 has killed more than 160,000 people across the country. We're still in that wave, and we're heading for winter. What does that mean? Helen Branswell has been covering this for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. And Helen, your headline is grim. Winter is coming. Why America's window of opportunity to beat back COVID-19 is closing. But you also say that there is good news. Start with the good news.
Well, the good news is there is still time to get the numbers down to much more livable levels. Unfortunately, you know, in many parts of the country, people seem to be really over this and sort of feeling like they can will it away. And of course, that isn't working.
Or we're reading about lawmakers in Idaho who want to pass legislation saying that they can control school openings because they don't think public policy should be made based on advice from experts who they consider elitist. This is what you say we're contending with, people who have completely different points of view. And the bad news is you have health experts saying you that winter could be Dickensingly bleak. You know, we're looking at Dickens. Because of everything that we're seeing now, things like pop-up restaurants and outdoor activities with less transmission, that's going to go away.
A lot of the things that we've been doing to sort of try to remind ourselves of what life was like before COVID, we're just not going to be able to do. You know, we spend more time indoors in winter, and indoor air is much more of a risk. We could really see a spike in numbers, especially if kids go back into schools and if schools become transmission zones for COVID. I mean, we could really get to much higher levels than we've seen now.
Yeah, and you're talking to people like Michael Osterholm, who believe that in that part of the good news, it is that there is time. But in that time, maybe we should consider a complete tough lockdown again.
Yes, he is suggesting that, and he's not alone in it. But of course, it's not a welcome proposal from, in many quarters. And of course, the country has never taken a national approach. It's being, this response is sort of operating on a state by state. And so trying to come up with a national response at this point seems kind of unlikely.
Yeah. And to be clear, Helen, you're not talking here about a second wave in the winter. You're talking about not getting out of the first wave.
Well, you know, some countries have managed to quell their first waves. In the United States, it never abated to the point where you would say the wave is over. It's just burning on.
Yeah. Well, and we haven't mentioned the flu. How is the flu going to impact COVID-19?
So nobody can be really sure how much flu we're going to have this winter. I mean, first of all, flu is extremely unpredictable. And it is possible that some of the measures that we're taking to try to suppress COVID transmission may help with flu. As we go forward, if somebody starts to feel ill, you're not easily going to be able to determine, is that COVID? Is this flu? And with the turnaround time for testing, it's going to be really difficult to determine who is sick with something that we don't really need to worry very much about and who is sick with COVID-19.
Grim Outlook. Helen Branswell with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
So this week, Russian President Vladimir Putin said his country's developed a coronavirus vaccine ready for public distribution and that his daughter has already taken a dose. Well, scientists in the U.S. are skeptical about safety. It's just too fast. But it does raise the question, where are we on vaccines here? When will we have one? Well, spoiler alert, no one really knows. But let's bring in Dr. Richard Kennedy. He leads the vaccine research group at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, one of the labs working to develop a coronavirus vaccine. Dr. Kennedy, welcome.
Hi, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
And talk about the timing. We've heard President Trump say we could have a vaccine by October. We've also heard Dr. Anthony Fauci say early next year. We're hearing scientists and researchers say, well, we need even more time than that. Where do you fall on this?
I'm probably with the majority of the scientists saying that we'll likely need more time than that. If we're all wrong and we get there faster, that'd be fantastic. But right now, where we're at with sort of the front runner vaccines are we've just started phase 3 clinical trials. And so it's going to be 3 or 4 months at least before we start having the data we need to make the decisions as to whether or not these vaccines are safe and effective.
And remind us what that is, phase 3.
Sure. That's the last phase before we can license a vaccine. And here we're talking, it's not hundreds, it's not 1,000, but tens of thousands of people that we need to test the vaccine in. And we're continuing to look at safety, but we're also looking at efficacy. And so now we need to study large populations, and the populations have to be people that are susceptible or at risk of the disease.
So are you talking about a vaccine that completely protects someone, gives them full immunity? Are you talking about vaccines that will lessen the severity or maybe give them short-term immunity? What are the vaccines looking for?
So the ideal situation is a protective vaccine, what we call sterile immunity. So if you get exposed again, the response is so strong that the virus can't even establish a foothold or infect you. That sometimes happens, but your immune response and vaccines, how they work, it's not like a light switch where it's off or on. It's more like a dimmer switch. So there is a variety of different partial immunity that you can get. So the flu vaccine is a great example. On a good year, it could protect you against infection. On a bad year, it might prevent you from having serious illness, but you still experience some symptoms. We don't know what we're going to see with the vaccines to coronavirus. And that's one of the things we're looking at during these phase 3 clinical trials.
Yeah. We do know a bit about the different methods. Now, your lab is working on one called a peptide vaccine. It would use parts of the coronavirus that the body then recognizes and will generate an immune response like, oh, I'm going to fight that off. And it produces the antibodies, which will then be protective when the real virus comes along. And, you know, we've reported on others that use RNA to almost be a Trojan horse to bring something into the body. Can you just briefly say what the different categories of vaccine are at this point?
Sure. So at a very high level, we have whole virus vaccines. Sometimes it's a live virus that's been weakened. Sometimes it's a killed or inactivated virus. And then we have what are called protein or subunit vaccines, where it's bits and pieces of the virus. And then we have vectored vaccines, where they take one piece of the virus, put it in another virus that we know can be safe, for example, adenovirus or measles virus. And then we have the RNA vaccines, and that's instead of a live virus, we're simply using RNA. The purpose of all of these different types of vaccines is to produce viral proteins in your body so that your immune system can recognize them and produce antibodies.
So different thoughts, different ways, everybody with the same goal, to have something that's safe. How do you calculate safe? Is there a certain number of people who, you know, this may not be safe for, but that's acceptable?
So each of the types of vaccines has different advantages and disadvantages. For example, the live virus vaccines typically have the strongest immune response. However, they've got live virus, and so they're in some ways less safe. For example, the measles vaccine and a lot of the other live virus vaccines we have are not given to, for example, pregnant women or anyone who has a condition that compromises or weakens their immune system. One of the reasons we're looking at all of these different types of vaccines is because they're likely going to be geared towards different target populations. How we measure safety usually requires very large study populations. And for the most part, vaccines are very safe, and most of them have side effects, things like your arm is hurt because we stuck a needle in your arm, or you have a brief fever, or you're feeling a little under the weather for a few days. More rarely, we have adverse events, a very high fever, maybe some nausea and vomiting. We're talking one in 5,000, 10,000, sometimes even one in 100,000 cases. In order to study those effects, we need very large clinical trials. For example, the Moderna and the Oxford trials, the phase 3 trials, they're going to have 20,000 people with the vaccine and 10,000 controls. That's only large enough to find side effects that are as rare as one in 5,000. So we'll get some information on safety, but rare adverse events or rare side effects, we're going to have to wait till we see large-scale use of these vaccines in the population.
You know, we already know, I'm repeating myself here, I've said this before, but we already know that there are people who are against vaccines who are, you know, hitching that campaign to the fact that the White House is moving so quickly on this. And there are concerns that maybe the safety will be put aside. Reassure people that when a vaccine does come out, it will have gone through safety checks. And also the benefits of a vaccine against coronavirus.
The process that we have in place right now to develop, test, and evaluate vaccines results in very safe, very effective vaccines. So it's important not to cut any corners. And what we're seeing is there's tremendous pressure, both from a political side and also from the public, to try and shorten the timeline to accelerate it. And there's things we can do to do that. We can run phase 1 and phase 2 trials together. We can make the trials larger to begin with. We can help the regulatory agencies review things quickly. We're also seeing a lot of companies create millions of doses of vaccine before they get the results back from the clinical testing. That way, if the trials are successful, they've already saved months of production time. The important thing is to not compromise any of the safety studies that we're doing. People are just going to have to accept the fact that that delay is important because we need a vaccine that works and we need one that's safe. It would be a disaster to have a vaccine come out that causes harm or simply doesn't work.
What about the production? And then, how long will it take to ramp that up?
Well, that's a great question. No company has ever created 7 or 8 billion doses of a vaccine, and yet that's kind of what the world is expecting to happen. And so it's likely going to be a united effort across multiple companies to create the vaccine doses that we need. Vaccines, depending on what kind they are, take anywhere from a couple of weeks to 6 months or so to develop. And so getting a jump start on that early on is very important.
And will some people get it before others, let's say frontline workers?
It's entirely possible, almost guaranteed, that we'll have to phase this appropriately. There's more demand than we will be able to have immediately available. And so they're going to have to come up with some phased approach. It's likely going to be given to the people that need it the most, the healthcare workers and frontline responders, or people who are older or have those comorbidities that we know predispose you to more serious disease.
Well, finally, Dr. Richard Kennedy, again, leading the vaccine research group at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. They have their own vaccine candidate that they're working on. How does it feel to be in this moment? Is it, you know, exciting? Who wouldn't want to have the Kennedy vaccine? I mean, you know, the name Salk is equal to life-saving. You know, to be a part of that, is that elating or exhausting?
It is a little of both. It's a little surreal because there's a tremendous amount of excitement because you can see immediate application for the work that you're involved in. And there's a sense of urgency and there's a little bit of pressure to get this done and get it done properly, but get it done in the shortest amount of time as possible. And the faster we get it done, the more lives we're able to save.
Well, we wish you the best. Again, Dr. Richard Kennedy from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, Rob.
Let's go to Belarus now, where a presidential candidate says she made the difficult decision to flee her country after disputing an election result that she and others believe was rigged. Through a YouTube message posted last night, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya said she fled the country for the sake of her children. For the third straight night, protesters have taken to the streets to contest the results of this election, which show that longtime President Alexander Lukashenko beat out his opponent by a landslide. Journalists report that police are attacking anti-government protesters and have detained thousands of people. And many there report the government has slowed down the ability to use the internet or phones to communicate with the outside world. Because of this, we had to get inventive with our next guest, Kate Shmatsina. She's a political analyst with the Belarusian Institute for Strategic Studies based in Minsk. The only way to communicate with Kate is through WhatsApp Messenger. So we sent her questions and she provided voice memos back to us right before nightfall. I began by asking her what the streets of the capital look like right now.
So the atmosphere on the Minsk streets is quite different in the daytime and in the night, because in the daytime, if you walk in the city center, it looks very peaceful, and then the pedestrians just walk on the streets with their daily routines. But during the nighttime, the streets turn into the place of protests, and people build barricades against the special police units, those who brutally disperse the crowds and use the rubber bullets. And we do not have any exact figures so far, because a bunch of journalists were either detained, some foreign journalists were deported from the country on the election day. The people's discontent with the government's actions is rising and isn't likely to go away.
Kate notes that not being able to get on the internet during these protests is unprecedented. And from her perspective, the government is intentionally throttling service to keep people from talking to each other.
I can recall something similar happening at the elections on the night of the election protests in 2010. But at that time, the police managed to disperse the protests within one night. And then the internet was working again. So this time is different because the protest moods are not stoppable at the moment. So the fact that the government is blaming outside interference, this is well, ridiculous, because this is happening not for the first time. And what is interesting is that you can actually open from your browser, you can still access the state media.
Even with spotty internet, people are still trying to communicate. They've effectively organized strikes at several factories using the messenger app Telegram.
People try to coordinate through Telegram channels, and there are a few Telegram channels that post regular updates on what is happening on the streets when people gather to protest. And they're designed that way that there is a chat bot, an anonymous one, where, like, if you want to share the information, you can post it there anonymously. And also people try to use the VPNs, proxies, other workarounds, but those are not reliable and mostly do not work.
Kate says people are protesting in the streets because of what they believe is an election that was unfair. Authorities have arrested at least 8 members of Tikhanovskaya's campaign. For many, the former teacher and housewife, who up until now had no political experience, is seen as the change the country needs after 26 years under the current leader. She has now fled to Lithuania, which Kate does not find surprising.
That was a very logical, rational move on behalf of the authorities, because if she was brought to jail, then this would have spiked even more protests among the population. But rather, the authorities decided to show the weakness, so to say, of Tikhanovskaya and just forcing her, possibly threatening her, to leave the country, and thus aspiring that people would question her authority, her reputation, and we cannot rely on this alternative political leader. But those are not the dominant moods among the population, and most of Tikhanovskaya's supporters, they understand that she was obviously threatened and she had little options other than just living.
Final results from the election are expected this Friday, with Lukashenko favored to win. Kate does not think this will necessarily stop the protests, and she's not sure what the future holds, especially for a political analyst like her.
Again, it is hard to predict whether anyone discontent with the current regime, whether we are safe. And there are some reports about some of my fellow experts detained, but it isn't clear whether they were detained due to their professional work or because they were taking part in the protests on the streets.
That was Kate Shmatsina. She's a political analyst at the Belarusian Institute for Strategic Studies. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.